My guest is Vera Jourova. Vera Jourova is the Vice President of the European Commission. She has a very wide-ranging portfolio, but for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to focus essentially on disinformation. Welcome to the podcast, Vera.
Thank you for having me and for your interest.
Thank you. Right. Well, we're recording this on the Tuesday, the 4th of June, just as the European Parliament elections get underway. So I'd like to start this conversation, Vera, if I may. We're talking about the prevalence of disinformation in an election context. How concerned are you about the prevalence of disinformation as we go to the polls, especially for the European Parliament?
I will not hide that I am concerned for a long time. You know, I was here already before elections in 2019. Already in those days, we saw that disinformation and fake news are influencing the people's minds and might manipulate part of the society and part of the voters. But in those days, it was more the issue of micro-targeting and abuse of private data, you know, not the dominant topic of disinformation as the main risk. Now it's a different story, and it's also because disinformation received a very strong ally, and it's artificial intelligence.
Right.
And so the amplification of disinformation through the AI tools, fake accounts, fake polls, for instance, which might mislead the people, of course, deepfakes, all these things might really decrease the even legality of the electoral process. Because I hope you are with me on the same page, the elections should remain the fair competition of real people,
right,
and real vision and real communication, and not just manipulation and pure marketing which misleads people. I don't want to live in the world when lying wins the elections.
Right, obviously disinformation with or without artificial intelligence is prevalent across all the different elections at the moment and generally in society. But in the context, again, of the European Parliament elections just around the corner, how does the EU, how does the European Commission, before it even starts to tackle and resist and combat disinformation, how does it simply identify and realise that this disinformation is actually taking place?
We have several very reliable sources of data.
Right.
First of all, our External Action Service.
Right.
Which is collecting data, especially documenting the Russian influence, but also China, Iran being active in our information space. The second set of data comes from the platforms, from the digital platforms. We asked them already several years ago. I was a nuisance for them over years because I kept asking them for new and new data.
Yeah.
And I did it in a polite way
by
saying, if somebody has the thermometer in hand, it's you. You can measure the temperature of Europe.
Right.
And it's pretty much true that their data, which they deliver to us, shows the trend, the appearance, the intensity of the disinformation in different member states. And it is a useful source of information illustrating that it is there, that disinformation appears in the information space and influences people. The third line of data comes from the European media observatories,
right,
which is growing as the structure in every member state. We have a group of researchers and NGOs and professionals who can differentiate between lie and truth, speaking about facts, not opinions, facts.
Yeah.
The fourth very valuable source of information is covering Central and Eastern European countries, including some Western Balkan countries, and it's the GlobSec organization. But there are some other organizations like GlobSec which equip us from time to time with some regional information. So, sorry about such a long story, but you asked what gives me the certainty that it's there. Well, the different sources are telling us exactly the same message. Yes, it is there, and it has the potential to grow.
The EU likes to talk about toolboxes, one of the favourite jargon phrases I'm sure you like, but do not like, I'm sure. What kind of tools are in these toolboxes, though, to combat disinformation?
When you say toolbox, I am about to faint.
I know you don't like jargon or acronyms.
Oh, yes. I hate it. No, because when I hear it from somebody else speak about toolbox, I never get additional information what's in it.
Yes, quite.
And that's what you ask me now.
Exactly.
About. Well, what's in the toolbox? First of all, speaking about the platforms, we need them to invest in high quality fact checking in all the member states and in all the languages. They cannot do it from one center in English.
Right.
And so this is about capacities, this is about paying sufficient attention to it, not underestimating the issue. That's why now I came to Silicon Valley to remind them of the situation here and that we really expect them to invest in high quality fact checking. The second thing is better data analysis from the side of the researchers, but also the commission, which is collecting data, and the member state, different bodies. Then I would like to see in the toolbox better work against the foreign interference, something similar to what we do against the cyber attacks from outside.
Right.
So it might contain some kind of sanction.
Okay.
So we have to work further on that.
Sanctions against the companies?
Against the foreign actors.
Right, foreign actors, okay.
Yeah, because at this moment we are sanctioning some of the vehicles for disinformation, which means we are sanctioning the so-called media established by Kremlin or funded by Kremlin or established by the sanctioned persons. So we started with Russia Today and Sputnik. In the last package, we have Izvestia and Voice of Europe and two more. And I think that we have to be better in early detecting of these hostile vehicles and stop them and sanction them in case we detect who they are. It's not only easy. And in the toolbox, I would like to see more coordination, especially at the level of the member states.
Okay.
And now I see a very good example of the Viginum agency in France, which is agency established by the state to focus on online foreign interference. And it's interesting structure, which might serve as an inspiration for other member states. Because different member states try to address this issue differently. Sometimes it belongs to the competence of one ministry, sometimes four or five ministries even. And without any cheap criticism, I want to say more and better coordination would be needed.
Right. You say you just come back from Silicon Valley. You've been to the West Coast a number of times during your mandate as commissioner and the vice president. And you obviously meet with the highest levels of these tech companies, the CEOs. What kind of reception do you get? Do you feel that they are just being polite, diplomatic, and receiving you graciously? But are they actually getting the message? Or do you feel, essentially, do you think you're making progress with these people?
I have a history with them. We started in 2016 when I was explaining why we need the GDPR.
Right.
It seems to be like medieval time now.
All the data protection.
Data protection. But then soon after, I asked them to voluntarily commit to do more against hate speech online in their system.
Yeah.
And you ask about the reaction of real people.
Mm-hmm.
I had that feeling, and I still have it, that the big men and women who are in the lead of these global companies, they don't want to be abused for spreading of crime.
Mm.
When I speak to real people, I always have the same feeling. Of course, then it's about business, it's about investing in protection of the information space, and over time, they understood more and more that we mean it, that what is illegal offline has to be treated as illegal online as well, that disinformation is becoming a security threat in the EU.
Yeah.
I think they understood, maybe especially from me, because I have some predispositions to understand who Putin is.
Yes, quite.
Being Czech. I think that more and more they understand that disinformation belongs to Russian military doctrine.
Right.
So what Putin is sending to their algorithms, to their ranking system, it's not words, it's weapons, it's ammunition. And I know I sound dramatic, but I'm not far from the reality that really this is part of the war.
But they must see that you have the carrot and the stick in there, because you have the carrot being pleasant diplomacy and just talking like civilized adults, but then the stick of legislation, regulations such as the Digital Services Act. So do you think that they are taking that, not even a threat anymore, but the reality of EU regulation to combat disinformation seriously and highlighting their own responsibility in dealing with this?
They take, I guess, Digital Services Act, I guess from my previous discussions, seriously,
right,
because there is a very high possible sanction. I think it's also a reputational issue when they are under investigations. But if they want to keep good business on our single market, of course they have to take it seriously and comply with the rules.
Mm.
The rules are demanding, what I also hear from them very often. But at the same time, what I hear is that in the EU they have sufficient legal certainty and predictability of the rules. Just compare it with the United States, where there might be one-off ban of some company or a surprising decision of the single court. We have different approach. We want the rules, which will be applied and enforced. That's the line of the stick which you mentioned.
Right.
I would not call it like that.
Okay.
Because then it would mean that I hold in my hand the carrot. Well, I think I hold in my hand the meaningful dialogue,
right,
which we also need to have with them. And although the enforcement line is a very precise, prudent, objective assessment, I have more space, because I am not part of the enforcement line, I have more space to speak with the big men and women from the big tech, also about the vision for the future, about what else should we do for the children, not to be the victims of this big business. And the victim of negligence on the side of others. Because I always say that if the children will have a parent TikTok, and father TikTok and mother Instagram, well, it's also our fault. So the dialogue is important to be kept ongoing, and it's not just explaining to them what we want from them. It's also part of it.
You said earlier that you'd like to see more coordination between member states also inside the European Union in this area. If I'm not mistaken, you were at the General Affairs Council just 2 weeks ago, where the Council approved conclusions on safeguarding electoral processes from foreign interference. Do you think member states still don't realise that there's a job to be done across member states as well as just nationally?
They do realize it.
Okay.
And it was an interesting moment that they called on more coordination on European level.
Right.
And I replied on, could you please do more coordination at member state level? But it was an important moment for sharing this feedback mutually, because I recognize we have to do more on the European level and coordination between External Action Service, me, colleagues who do the security agenda and education agenda. It's important, and I think that we will see more of this coordinated approach in the next commission, I guess. It's just my guess. At the same time, when I come to a member state where I have a round table with five deputy ministers from Ministry of Home Affairs, Foreign Affairs, Digitalization, Defense, Education, and I have a feeling that they say things which the others hear for the first time. You know, the lack of sharing of information, not speaking about coordination. Then, of course, my message is, it would be good if you create some synergy. And Also, if you create one contact point for the platforms, be in to create a communication bridge, because what the platforms are telling me, well, we not often understand what are the vulnerabilities of the member state, what is the sensitive language used there. My answer to it is hire local people to do the fact checking.
Yeah.
But still, the bridge between the platforms and member states is more or less missing.
Right, that's still work in progress, well, to be done. We talked then about institutions, European and national governments and agency. We talked about the tech companies. What about the private individual? Has artificial intelligence in particular made disinformation so realistic, so susceptible to being believed, so well done, that it's impossible and almost redundant to ask the individual himself or herself to be more vigilant? Or do you think there's more work to be done in that area also to educate people about, to try and, in their own terms, navigate and identify and spot examples, instances of disinformation?
Mm. We didn't invent anything better than to make people know that what they see is either full or part production and creation of AI.
Yeah.
So this notification or label or watermark should tell them, let's not believe it at all, or let's take it with some reserve. Yeah, some warning. Because if we resign on it, then we might get either to the situation when the people will stop believing anything, or they will be so manipulated that they will believe everything they see. Both extremes are very, very dangerous. That's why we had to invite the individuals to this game and to let them know, look, consider yourself, what you choose, what you want to believe, and whether you will not reach to some trustworthy source of information to check. We have not invented anything better for the moment. But the labeling, I predict, will not be sufficient in the immediate, longer term time, because as the experts are telling us, more and more everything you see online is with some portion of AI due to the ChatGPT and next generation of very big models. So we will have to think over how to cope with it.
There's an obvious connection between what we've been talking about till now, Vera, and the rule of law, another important part of your portfolio. Since it is so topical, may I ask you, what is your view about Hungary, about this idea that voting rights should be removed from Hungary as an extreme step because member states, quote unquote, have run out of patience with how Viktor Orban has been behaving for quite some time now?
Until you have 26 member states willing to vote for it, it's just a theoretical discussion.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you think there would not be unanimity between 26?
Ask them. When we had a very heated debate around Hungary after they adopted the law on education, which stigmatized LGBT people, it was really very upset reaction from some member states.
Okay.
Because it was, I think, 2 days before the General Affairs Council,
right,
when we discussed the Hungarian case. The Hungarian minister had a tough time to explain why they adopted such law, which puts the LGBT people to the same level of behavior as pedophiles. It was quite shocking they did by this law. Believe me or not, believe me rather than not, there were only 18 member states who signed the declaration that the law is outrageous. But speaking about this specific story, the declaration was written with the best possible interest, but there was nothing about Hungary. It was very general that we should not adopt laws which discriminate upon some minorities and so on. It was so general that at the end, the Hungarian minister asked me, can I also sign the declaration?
Okay.
And, you know, that's the shame of diplomatic language and
It's too polite.
Political correctness.
Yeah.
Well, the declaration should have been concrete.
With stronger words.
Stronger and concrete words. But just coming back to the arithmetics, we only had in this heatest moment 18 member states. So to speak about the depriving Hungary of the voting rights, it's true that after the invasion of Russia to Ukraine and after the permanent positioning of Hungary against the support to Ukraine, there are maybe more than 18 member states now upset.
All right. Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But I would not bet on it that there will be 26 ministers.
Okay. Well, we're coming to the end of this conversation already, Vera. And I'd like to ask you a bit to reflect very briefly. You've been here in Brussels for two commission terms now. That's 10 years, as you
too
said.
Long.
It's a long time. Let me ask you a question if you're able to answer it. When you signed on for the job 10 years ago, has it turned out to what you expected? And linked to that, what kind of, without not a long, long list, but what kind of things have you learnt now 10 years later that you didn't think would be the case you would be thinking about 10 years ago in the job?
You know my horrible sense of humor. So my colleague is now nervous what I am going to say. No, at the beginning, I could not imagine, as the country minister, that I will be involved in really big decision making about strategic big things, which will mark the future for the whole continent. It was not that ability to imagine the level of responsibility, and to some extent burden, and demands which will fall upon me to be able to do the job at all. And so it was, of course, gradual, also growing process. And at this moment, looking back, I am really grateful to, who helped me to get this job twice. And I am especially grateful for having the chance to work with Ursula, because she showed leadership. And it was an honor to work with her.
A final question. You won't be here to see it, but there's a lot of talk, as you know, about the next commission, whoever ends up being the president, should and will want to focus much more on implementation and enforcement of existing rules and regulations, as well as maybe proposing new rules and regulation. Do you see that as a positive thing? That's something that has to be done? Do you recognize the validity of that particular argument?
Of course, it's not sexy not to come with new things. It's not so sexy and so visible when you just do the proper thing, which is needed, proper implementation of the existing rules. And for a politician, it's too tempting to do new things. So I would wish the new commission to think twice about new regulations. I think that the most sexy thing would be to radically deregulate.
Okay.
Especially the rules for the small and medium enterprises.
And to do a kind of an inventory of rules.
To deregulate everything which is connected with the technological development.
Which have a disproportionate negative impact on small businesses.
I'm afraid that if we continue with heavy regulation, we could really one day start stopping the innovations and motivation of the companies and people to do new things. Because because Europe is quite a risk-averse continent.
Right.
And it reflects, of course, in the way we regulate. But the new leaders should be able to have the sense for proportionality and necessity.
Right. Thoughtful words. Well, we have to leave it there. Vera Jourová, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for your interest.